May it please the court.
Certainly.
The issue before the court today on this penalty retrial is whether counsel should have investigated significant matters that went to showing that Michael Tysius was not a threat or harm to anyone at the Potosi Correctional Center, and whether or not he should have been sentenced to death. There were three important pieces of evidence that counsel was on notice the state was going to bring in, one being this guilty plea to having a boot shank in the prison, a statement attributed to him by a jail guard suggesting that he was bragging about what the offense he committed, and then a third incident that is described as mimicking displaying a gun towards this jail guard. What happened here is all of these factors go to his alleged future dangerousness in prison. And what we saw was a one-sided mini-trial. Counsel said they didn't want a mini-trial on these things. Well, they got a mini-trial that was all one-sided. Beginning an opening statement, the state put the jury on notice that, and this was the prosecutor's words, Michael Tysius decided he needs a weapon, a boot shank, a weapon you could cut somebody up with. So at the very outset, the jury was on notice that this was a dangerous instrument that could be used to harm someone and harm them grievously so. The aggravation evidence that came in was along the same lines, that he had was convicted of this possessing the boot shank and then the two jail guard incidents. In closing arguments, the jury heard that Mr. Tysius got a freebie on the boot shank because he got a five-year concurrent sentence, and that he had bragged about his actions that resulted in him being incarcerated.
Now, he was convicted of killing two Randolph County guards. How did that have to do with the shank?
I'm sorry. He was convicted of the two guards in terms of the shank.
Right. How's the shank have anything to do with killing the two guards?
It's not related to the actual acts of killing the guards, but it was introduced as aggravation as to why he posed a threat to people at Potosi, because it was alleged that he had this shank and could have used it to hurt someone at Potosi, so therefore he was more deserving of death. It doesn't go to the actual facts of the crime itself. It goes to why he should be sentenced to death, and it was a subsequent event that happened while he was in prison at the Potosi Correctional Center.
Thank you.
The boot shank, all these items of evidence were essential to the state's case, but especially the boot shank. And we have to really look at this boot shank and all of these pieces of evidence from the perspective of this court's decision in the Irvin case. Counsel has an affirmative duty to rebut aggravation. Here, counsel was on notice of all of these things and took no action to rebut any of them. In particular, the plea transcript was valuable in that it could have been used to show the prosecutor's rendition of what happened here was that Mr. Tysius, at a disciplinary hearing, had said, yes, he had this, but he was coerced by another inmate who was an inmate who had actually killed his cellmate to keep this in his radio. Had counsel offered the plea transcript, the jury would have heard that this was done as an Alford plea where there was not an admission of guilt. It is just an acknowledgement that the state could prove its case against Mr. Tysius, but that he was not admitting guilt. At the
trial court found that it would have been a double-edged sword to admit more information about the boot shank, and that it would have gotten in Tysius's version of events, but it would also have get some of the details of the state's version of events that the jury had not heard. And would have brought out that he had done an Alford plea, and while in some ways that's a benefit, he didn't admit guilt, it also would perhaps have, he thought, tied into lack of remorse for misconduct. And so the trial, but point being that we normally defer to the trial court's interpretation of the evidence if there's some basis in the record there. You're asking us to substitute our judgment as to whether or not this would have been dispositive, aren't you? Or would have had made a difference to the outcome of the case?
I'm not asking you to substitute.
To second-guess trial strategy, which is what the trial court found, basically.
This was not a strategy, because counsel testified. They just did nothing with it. It's not a reasoned strategy to take no action. In terms of the idea of lack of remorse, Mr. Tysius doesn't have to be remorseful for an act he said he didn't commit. And actually, under Irvin, I mean, he was being victimized by someone else at the Potosi Correctional Center, and that he was being coerced by someone who had killed his cellmate to keep this. So,
but that's his version of the facts.
Right, but that was the version that the prosecutor gave at his plea. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, if the state is going to rely on it for those purposes to find him guilty of possessing the shank, the jury ought to hear that version because the state gave credence to it in doing it as an Alford plea.
And the state says that did come out in a very brief form through testimony of someone else, that he claims he was holding it for someone else, I think was.
There was a brief allusion to it by Dr. Taylor, but Dr. Taylor was just destroyed because she was not on notice of these three pieces of aggravation. She admitted she did not know about them. So while she made a brief cursory reference to it, the jury didn't get to hear what the prosecutor relied on at that plea shank guilty plea. And that's what is critical, is to hear, you know, the state relied on this. This is what the state's rendition and version was. And they gave credence to what Michael Tyson has said at this disciplinary hearing.
So do you think that those facts keep the motion court from finding that the jury may have used that evidence to Mr. Tyson's prejudice?
I think the motion court is clearly erroneous in that this is not a reasonable strategy, and that's effectively what they're saying.
Wasn't he worried about the idea of having a little mini trial on something that was pled? I mean, if he brings this out, then can't the state come in and say, here's what the evidence would have been? Why would they be necessarily completely tied to the factual basis? They could say, well, we let him do an Alford plea because this is what he wanted to say, but he knew the evidence was overwhelming. That's the purpose of the Alford plea. Then during the penalty phase, you've got all this discussion about the Alford plea and what the evidence would have been if we went to trial versus his version of facts.
Judge, you're suggesting that the state had more, and there's nothing in this record that supports that. If the state had that, there's nothing to support that. That's just pure speculation to suggest that the state might have put on other things. In fact, there's nothing to suggest that at all because they don't have it to put on. What they had was what the prosecutor gave at the guilty plea hearing, and it is borne out by this witness O'Hara's testimony and confirmed through O'Hara. O'Hara's testimony, we believe, is proper under Green, and that there are factors that point that O'Hara's testimony would have been admissible, along with mitigation specialist Miller. And those kinds of facts are O'Hara's testimony reflects what the prosecutor said, that being that it was his understanding that the shank was put there by Hurt, who was the person who killed the cellmate, that Hurt had a reputation for violence, and for being a snitch that set up other inmates. So those are the kinds of things that actually could have come in. And this idea of avoiding a mini trial is not a reasonable strategy under Irvin. It's like in Irvin's case, what happened was Irvin, it was portrayed as Irvin was assaulting his cellmate when in fact he was trying to help him. Well, here we have Mr. Tysius being victimized by this Hurt who's killed his cellmate, and instead, the jury is left with the perception that Mr. Tyson is trying to victimize staff, other inmates.
The trial court also found that, or the motion court, that there's no reasonable probability that the shank evidence that you say should have been brought in would have altered the result of the trial. And I know there's two other incidents you think also went to future dangerousness or dangerousness. Can you address why you think the trial court found those were insufficient, though, given the nature of the offense and the other evidence? You obviously think they were sufficient and might have affected the outcome of the trial. Can you address that issue for us?
The trial court found that they wouldn't have altered the result. But I think you have to look at the overall picture here of the boot shank and the other two pieces of evidence. And I think you have to put them together. I mean, the shank is the most critical piece because it says he's a potential harm to other people. And I just disagree with the court's finding. And I don't think that's a reasonable finding when you look at the Irvin case. I think it's wrong under Irvin because of this contrast that you're setting up between an inmate who is going to harm other people versus an inmate who's going to help people in Irvin, and here you have an inmate who's being victimized being accused of potentially being someone who will victimize other people. And I think that's where the trial court is, the motion court is wrong in terms of that finding.
Okay. Thank you.
In terms of one of the, I think, more compelling pieces that we have here that counsel was just oblivious to was Mr. Tyce's property records reflect that he never owned a pair of boots. So that is very much supportive of the idea that this was not his, that this was put in his radio by someone else. If he didn't own a pair of boots, this boot shank had to come from somewhere else. And that was a piece of evidence that trial counsel was just did nothing about and didn't know about and didn't have that. This also, for O'Hara, there are personal safety risks for him coming forward and testifying on Mr. Tyson's behalf against Hurt when you take into account Hurt is someone who had already killed his own cellmate, and that's why he was serving the sentence that he was. Another piece that I think is really critical here is that that plea transcript would have been useful from the perspective of the plea court explained what an Alford plea is about. And counsel, Mr. Slusher, testified he thought that would be a really critical piece for the jury to know that this was an Alford plea, that Mr. Tyce was not admitting guilt. In fact, when the state was wanting to introduce the shank evidence, he objected that this was an Alford plea. He doesn't remember that when he testifies at the post-conviction hearing, but that was his grounds for objection, that it was an Alford plea, it was not an admission of guilt, and he felt, and that was his testimony at the 2915, that this was compelling, that would have been compelling. He analogized it to the situation where people who are jurors would be familiar with the idea of what is a nolo contendere plea, and he said this would have been really helpful and acknowledged that this is something that would have been helpful to the jury. Mr. Schlesher also in his testimony acknowledged that the counsel had a letter that Mr. Tyce had written to the warden, informing the warden that Hurt was the one who was responsible for putting the shank in his radio. So having those pieces of evidence, it was counsel's duty to look further. The testimony of the PCR was they didn't even get the guilty plea transcript from the shank case. So how can you make a reasonable strategy decision when you haven't even read that plea transcript? There's no basis for a strategic finding here. In terms of one of the arguments the state has made here is that this evidence, all of it wouldn't have made any difference because Mr. Tyce had a death sentence before. But I think this court has to factor in that first death sentence was set aside because of the use of this Moe murder refrain that was in there. And the motion court granted relief on that. So that really prejudicially infected that first penalty phase. So to say, well, you get death once before, you know, it's just a repeat here. And that was a piece of evidence that did not come in this time. It was a piece of evidence that the motion court was found both a Brady violation and also counsel's ineffectiveness on that Moe murder tape, which was highly prejudicial, highly inflammatory, and used to show Mr. Tyce's intent for purposes of penalty. Counsel here did nothing in terms of investigating these things. And under Irvin, that is not a reasonable strategy. Counsel has an affirmative obligation under this court's Irvin decision to investigate aggravation. And counsel just did not do that here. If they had investigated the aggravation, they would have learned these three pieces of evidence that would have supported Mr. Tyce's getting a life sentence and shown that he's not a threat to other people in the prison environment. In fact, counsel had information that he'd often requested to be in protective custody because he feared for his life from other inmates. One of the pieces that relates to the statements attributed to Mr. Tyce deals with suggesting that he was bragging. And counsel was on notice of that from the very first. That was used in guilt phase of the first trial. So to not have investigated that and to fail to present evidence that counted that, which they could have through an expert explaining that this was linked to, that statement was linked to his psychological mental problems that he had, his PTSD, and linked it up was not effective assistance of counsel. Counsel ought to be held to the burden of investigating and presenting that kind of evidence through the expert they had. I see that my time is over right now. And
we'll hear from you on rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, start with the point one. That's really the only point that was addressed in any detail. Counsel was not ineffective for failing to offer additional evidence to cast doubt on appellant's possession of a prohibited item. Conviction, appellant primarily today leans on the idea of not introducing this plea transcript. First of all, as the court's already pointed out, Dr. Taylor testified to essentially the same thing that the plea transcript said to attempt to mitigate appellant's guilt for this crime, and that's that another inmate put it in there.
It was a single phrase,
but that single phrase says appellant told me that somebody else put it in there. And she also then, first of all, appellant said that she didn't know about this evidence. That's not true. She did know about the Bootshank evidence. She testified to that. And she also said, but I don't think that also shows any future dangerousness. It's not necessarily evidence of that, especially because it's not his fault. And so not only was she able to say that sentence, which is not that much more substantial than what appellant said at the Alford hearing, what was introduced at the Alford hearing about appellant's alternative explanation for the crime. It wasn't as substantial as appellant makes out today when you take into account these other things, as such the inmate heard it from a guy who heard it from a guy testimony or showing the boot shank itself. What that plea transcript also would have shown is that the crime appellant pled guilty to was possessing a prohibited item in the Department of Corrections, which could have been used in such a manner to endanger life or limb. Here is what counsel achieved with this evidence. Counsel realized he entered a plea, he's convicted of the crime, there's not much we can do about that. But what counsel actually achieved at trial was keeping that phrase out of evidence. And so while the state argued it's a weapon, the evidence didn't like establish that appellant conceded that it was a weapon. But the plea transcript did that. Appellant admitted that the crime that he was pleading to and that the evidence would show that the boot shank itself was an object that could be used in such a manner to endanger life or limb. It essentially helps provide further evidence to the jury that appellant was a danger because appellant possessed this item. Appellant possessed the item. He was found guilty of doing that. He admitted that the evidence showed that he did that. Whether he possessed it because he intended to use it or whether he possessed it because someone else intended to use it and wanted him to keep it there doesn't make appellant less culpable for the act of possessing it. And regardless of what appellant was willing to admit to, the conviction was still valid. The state could still argue every inference that it could argue whether he admitted that he was guilty of that crime or whether he simply admitted that the evidence showed he was guilty of this crime. Appellant's insistence that the jury knowing that he didn't admit guilt does not provide such an overwhelming, differently spin on this evidence that you would go, well, that evidence would aggravate under this circumstance, but wouldn't aggravate under that circumstance.
So you don't think it's significant that there was evidence that it was for self-protection rather than evidence that it was for a weapon for aggression?
I don't know that appellant's evidence even showed that. It wasn't necessarily that he was saying, I had it for self-protection.
Well, he said, I kept it for him because he'd kill me or beat me up if I didn't. So in that sense.
Right. And that's what he's saying. I was coerced into doing it. Not that I had it to protect myself, but that I had to do it because this guy was going to beat me up. Here's the problem with that evidence. That the plea transcript was not going to fully establish that. Appellant, for counsel to be ineffective, there had to be evidence, credible, admissible evidence that counsel could have admitted to establish this fact that I was threatened by this really bad inmate who was going to kill me or beat me up because he kills other people, and also that he likes to set people up and snitch on them. There were all these allegations made in the amended motion and at the evidentiary hearing. The problem is none of it was admissible evidence. O'Hara's testimony was not admissible. He basically meant, well, did you know this from personal knowledge? No. I just know because people know. That's not reliable hearsay. The appellant relies on this Green case to say far. Essentially, appellant's argument with the Green case is that the rules of evidence don't apply to the defense in a mitigation for mitigation evidence, and that's not what Green says. Green says where evidence is inherently reliable, the hearsay rule won't keep it out.
Of course, if it's admitted to show why he hit it, not that it's true, but that why he feared this guy, not that it's true that this guy was a killer or that he had a reason to, but the reputation of the other inmate as a killer was what caused him to hide the other guy's knife.
Well, except that that would be false. If it's he wanted, and I don't agree with that necessarily with like for O'Hara's testimony, which was really the only testimony that appellant was willing to offer.
O'Hara would have testified to this guy had this reputation, whether deserved or not. Why isn't that something that can come in if he personally knows the guy's reputation?
That's not the that's not the testimony that he offered. The testimony that he offered was, this guy, people know that this guy sets people up. But as for the stashing the item and the thing, no, all that O'Hara testified, like, well, I know that he did it.
What about the cumulative effect of this and the other two incidents, which also went to future dangerousness?
The cumulative effect, you can only take cumulative effect into account on the prejudice ring, not on the deficiency issue.
If the court were to find that each of these three, it was error, but we're not sure whether it was prejudicial, can you address why you think singular, to get separately or together, it would not have affected, there's no reasonable probability it would have affected the outcome of the trial?
Sure. First of all, there were five different statutory aggravating factors that the jury found. This court stated on the previous appeal said this crime was premeditated, and this crime was calculating, this crime was brazen. The severity of this crime and that the fact that on the statutory aggravating circumstances alone, this crime merited death was extremely strong in this case. Further, as to each of these pieces of evidence, we don't have a showing that the counsel was so deficient in not addressing. We can't just look and say counsel didn't do anything about any of this evidence, and so all of the counsel was deficient on each of these. Counsel's admission is that on the Boutchenk evidence, they took the most hands-off approach, that they said, we just kind of want to get through it and get to our theme of the case. But especially as to the evidence, first we think as to the Boutchenk evidence, counsel did do something to minimize the impact by keeping out that it was a weapon. One of the claims appellant raised in his thing is like, well, you didn't show this thing was a weapon, except that appellant admitted that he pled guilty. Counsel was able to keep that out. On the issue with the failing to challenge the statement to Petrie, counsel did elicit evidence that the statement that she made may not have been bragging, but for that claim, I think you can't overlook the fact that it's a material appellant's claim on appeal is a materially different claim than he raised below, because he said in one case it was bragging, but it wasn't. He didn't really mean it as bragging. Versus on appeal, he said, well, it wasn't bragging at all. You can't overlook that the testimony that he proposed in step two was inadmissible. It wasn't expert testimony. You don't need an expert to say, well, he said that statement, but he might have meant this by it. That's something that a layperson can understand. And Dr. Peterson's testimony on that was highly subjective. He goes, well, there really wasn't any context for me to figure out. He might have meant that. He might have meant that. That's not expert testimony. If counsel... Appellant doesn't just have to prove, well, these three things were prejudicial. Appellant has to prove, one, that counsel's performance was deficient, two, that counsel could have done something differently, and then three, were these prejudicial. On point two, he utterly failed to present a claim that there was admissible evidence that he could have presented. Plus, counsel did exactly what appellant says now that counsel should have done. Counsel was able to suggest that didn't necessarily mean that he was bragging. Appellant failed to prove that claim. As to the claim with the Chariton County Jail, gun gesture, counsel can reasonably decide to forego further investigation. And here, counsel was prepared to confront this evidence. Counsel was aware of information about Jailer Harmon's ability to see. Counsel cross-examined her about the distance about the obscuring nature of the glass on the door, about the lighting conditions, about the relative positioning. Counsel elicited that some inmates communicate via hand signals and that she couldn't be sure that what she saw was actually some kind of threatening gesture. She couldn't be sure, counsel elicited that she couldn't be sure that appellant could see her, and therefore that appellant would know that he was gesturing to her as opposed to making some kind of signal to something else. Counsel established that she had made a prior and consistent statement about that encounter and claimed that she could hear appellant say something, and later she admitted, no, that wasn't true. Counsel had investigated this evidence. Counsel was aware of this evidence. Counsel could have concluded, that's enough for us. We don't want to get further into this. And what we found with that, with the photos and we basically just had a battle of witnesses again at the evidentiary hearing. One investigator said, sure, you could clearly see in that window. When you were actually there and you actually looked, I could see a person standing at the window doing that. The other investigator said, well, there were parts of the cell that you couldn't see, but he didn't actually eliminate the fact that you could see. Appellant has to prove that failure to present evidence, the evidence would present a viable defense. And here, especially on points 2 and point 3, he utterly failed to present evidence to support his claim. And then as to point 1, look, here's yet another factor that the motion court could look at. One, the evidence and aggravation of this case was pretty overwhelming, that you could say, well, I didn't really admit my guilt and it wasn't my fault. Even though he was found guilty, because he admitted the evidence was guilty, doesn't provide that much of a mitigating fact in light of the overwhelming evidence. Finally, let's give appellant his inferences. Let's say that the motion court wasn't required to do, but let's say the jury actually believed appellant didn't commit this crime because he himself was an aggressive person who wants to kill every guard he sees. Let's say that appellant hid this because an older inmate manipulated him into keeping this weapon that could be used to harm other guards or other inmates. That's exactly the same circumstances that we had in this case. Appellant claimed his defense, this crime, was that, well, an older man influenced me to commit a crime and kill jailers. The fact that appellant believes it's mitigating to say, an older man convinced me to commit a crime that suggested a danger to other jailers, is just simply not mitigating under the circumstances of this case. The evidence of appellant's, in aggravation of appellant's sentence, was not just sufficient but overwhelming. Counsel confronted each of these areas of evidence. That appellant believes he should have done it a little, counsel should have done it a little bit differently, does not lead to the kind of sea change like we see in Irvin, where Irvin was, they didn't investigate it, and it turns out the evidence in aggravation was just wrong. This evidence wasn't wrong. Appellant just believes another inference should be raised for it. That's not sufficient to show a reasonable probability of a different result on trial. That was his burden to show, and he failed to do it. Appellant failed to prove that counsel was ineffective for presenting any of this evidence.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The state has said that there were 5 aggravators found as to these convictions. There were actually, as to one count, there was 3 aggravators, and as to another count, there was only 2 aggravators. And that's evidenced by the verdict forms that are in the legal file. So that's just inaccurate information. As far as Dr. Taylor's testimony, I've set forth in detail what Dr. Taylor's testimony was as to her acknowledgement of what she knew about the boot shank. It's on page 17 of my reply brief, and she barely knew. She had a cursory familiarity with it, and I'll read to the court what happened on cross of her. During cross of her, she acknowledges she had a cursory recognition, and the prosecutor says to her, should we believe him? And then on recross, the prosecutor attacks Taylor, asking her, she didn't have the information, did she, about mimicking shooting a guard, bragging about killing, and having a boot shank. So the prosecutor on recross said she didn't have that. So I don't see how the state can say now she had it when the prosecutor's cross was she didn't have it. Dr. Taylor was impeached significantly. Her credibility was just ultimately destroyed. So to say what she had to say had any bearing on how the jury would perceive the shank just is not reasonable. These attorneys did not investigate, and they acknowledged they did nothing. Their reason for doing nothing was they didn't want a mini trial. Well, mini trial doesn't cut it under Irvin. The state points out that part of the charging document was kept out. Well, the jury repeatedly heard an opening statement and closing argument in its evidence that Michael Tysius had this because his intention was to use it to harm someone else, whether that be a staff member, another inmate, and all. So to not say that this was prejudicial when the state used it in such a prejudicial fashion just ignores reality as to how this evidence was used against him as to the boot shank. He admitted that he possessed the boot shank, but he did not admit the intention that was attributed to him by the state in this penalty phase, that he intended to use it in a harmful manner. What he admitted to doing was possessing it because he was coerced by someone else who had already killed the cellmate to hold on to this. And that was an inmate who had a long reputation of setting other people up. O'Hara's testimony was admissible under both Green and this court's decision in Phillips. If you look at the plea transcript, O'Hara's testimony mirrors what the prosecutor said at that plea and on the Shank case. We also have to look at the similarity of what Hurt had done in the past. His case records, which are now part of this record, show that he used a homemade knife to stab his cellmate. Well, that's essentially what the contention was, that this shank would be done. It would be turned into a homemade knife. So we've got consistency there under both Green and under Phillips as to the reliability. And that's what we're talking about here, is reliability under Green and under Phillips. We're looking at factors that have reliability. So we have Hurt doing the same thing again. The prosecutor at the shank plea said that this information about the shank came on a tip from a reliable informant. O'Hara said that Hurt was known to be an informant who basically snitched on other inmates and set them up. We also have Mr. Tysius' property records, which show he never possessed a pair of boots. This had to originate from someone other than Mr. Tysius. He didn't tear that boot shank out of a boot. Someone else had to, and it wasn't his boots because he didn't own any boots. In addition, we have to look at the personal safety risk to O'Hara with him testifying. This is not, you know, without risk to him, because Hurt is someone who has killed a cellmate. So if he's coming forward to testify about Hurt and that it was Hurt who put this in Tysius's radio, there's a risk to him to being stabbed or killed by Hurt. It was important also that counsel, they called Dr. Peterson at trial to have Dr. Peterson link up Mr. Tysius' PTSD with a statement that was attributed to him by the jail guard and all. And he could have done that. He could have explained this is part of his PTSD. And linking that up is really an important piece because it goes to his psychological disorder and it refutes the idea that he was bragging. And that was something that was driven home to the jury, that he was bragging about this by that statement. Likewise, in terms of the lighting conditions in the jail, all counsel had to do was get pictures. That's all that was required, and get it with the lights out. The state's witness who testified at the PCR did it with lights on. And we feel that those would have been another piece of evidence. So when you cumulatively look at all of these pieces of evidence, the guilty plea transcript from the shank, the testimony of O'Hara, the testimony that could have been presented by Dr. Peterson, and also this lighting conditions of the jail, these cumulatively would have moved the jury to not vote for death and not impose death in this situation. I see that my time is up. Unless the court has other questions,
thank you.
I would ask the court reverse this penalty phase for a new penalty phase.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.